This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Welcome to Tuesday Home Time with Joan Bartlett. 2 hours of current affairs on Melbourne's community radio station 3CR. Today we hear from activist for Palestine Rob Martin, back home recovering from his time in the custody after being kidnapped with other activists from the Gaza Freedom Flotilla boat in international waters. Dr. Alison Brynoska with 11 opportunities for the Australian government to move towards independence. We hear from genetic engineering director Bob Phelps monthly. Today it's Bob's turn, hearing about his life of activism. Associate Professor Peter Slezak, looking at the issues of truth, justice and free speech in a decent society. But it's good news. He's back, Mr. Kevin Healy, and we have his week that was.
A week, Jane Lister, when after 22 months of supporting the slaughter, destruction, genocide and starvation of Zion's right to defend itself when non-land, non-people it occupies illegally object to being terrorised after 77 years of terror and displacement, 22 months, True Blue Aussie decided maybe the non-land, non-people do have a right to be people with a land, as long as they don't want the country that used to be theirs in the first place before True Blue Aussie joined our very, very, very close friends in voting to cast them out. But then sometimes we wonder whether caring business class party supremo and would-be big supremos Sussan, Lees and Dregs knows what she's talking about. Terrorists were applauding True Blue Aussie's decision, she said, but they weren't. Zion supremo Benjamin, not another Yahoo, and his Zion supporters here and there had nothing but severe criticism. Sussan, check your facts before you open your mouth. Indeed, the Zion apologists were out in force, egged on, well, reported responsibly with his renowned objectivity by Lord Rupert of Wapping, screaming Wapping Sin P1, a win for Hamas. Jewish groups accuse PM of shocking betrayal after recognising Palestinian state. Inside, four pages of similar balanced coverage. More Wednesday. Nobody's happy at his Gaza decision. Thursday, P1 screamer again. Hero of Hamas, terrorist cheer, PM's courage. Courage in parentheses. Get the feeling, but could be wrong, get the feeling Lord Rupert and his editorial lackeys don't support the decision, and those Jewish groups, quote, accusing big supremo Anthony Albanese, we assume, don't include those many, many, many Jews who oppose Zion and the slaughter, destruction, genocide and starvation, who march week after week. And when I heard the shadowy minister for going overseas all the time and being a perfectly good little prefect, Michaela Koch, the workers, repeating over and over the rewarding terrorism trope, my only thought was, I can understand it if Michaela's elocution teacher committed suicide. After stating he would bide his time on recognising a Palestinian state, and I wish someone would tell us just where it's going to be, there was some silly suggestion Anthony had been forced to move by public pressure, public opinion, and a near revolt within the Socialist Party. But the Socialist commitment was evident as the great defenders of Zion's right to defend itself, to slaughter and starve the innocent, the minister be going overseas all the time and being a perfectly good little prefect, Penny left wing, the minister for being offensive and train killing Richard Moles, the bad guys, he of the giant mind. Even big economic guru Jim Chalmers Capital all informed us they had been fighting for the non-land, non-people all along. So obviously their 22-month campaign demonising the Sunday rallies as anti-Semitic hate fests was a brilliant tactic aimed at fooling the Zion supporters and their media into thinking it supported Zion, thus hiding its real intent. So words are words, Anthony, but of course you'll stop sending the Merchant of Death parts bombing the proverbial out of the non-land, non-peoples, non-land, and sanction the warmongers? Certainly not. There is no need. We do not send arms to Zion. Oh, and why should we and our very, very, very close friends determine who can and who can't govern a Palestinian state? Because they've proven they can't be trusted to get it right. Right, okay, oh, sorry. Right, okay. By the way, Anthony, does this mean Fatima Payman will be readmitted to your caucus? No, caucus will not condone people voting for party policy. In the which bit of that is not a surprise, Department, Sussan and Michaela told us a coalition government would not recognise a Palestinian state. Imagine how that must have upset the slaughtered, destructed, genocided and starved non-land, non-people terrorists. And in one of the most big-hearted and generous offers we've heard for a long time, Benjamin said the occupied non-land, non-people could become not occupied voluntarily by leaving, and he wouldn't stop them. And if they don't want to leave voluntarily, then they will leave involuntarily, confirming his big idea to pack them all off to Sudan, vying with Gaza in the starvation stakes. Not that it matters, because starvation is starvation. Not unrelated, as humans, perceiving ourselves as the apex predator, extend genocide to species after species with whom we share or used to share the planet, a cruel and unwarranted attack on one of our own. The minister for doing all that to the environment, Murray Swatch the environment, accused, oh how unfair is life, accused by former Green Senator Bob Brown, note Brown, not Green, of being a corporate lackey. Murray Swatch the environment, a corporate lackey? Why? Just this week, a Western Troubler was a resource pollution executive. In other words, a really important and responsible person praised Murray. His approach markedly different to his predecessor, Tania Plibersunk. I think people appreciate his approach compared to Plibersunk's, the very, very important executive eulogized. Our relationship with Plibersunk broke down, he conceded. Any wonder she wanted to establish a federal environment protection authority that would go some way to protecting the environment, which the great transnational resource polluters thought could make life a bit more difficult for them. Backed by their socialist state supremo Roger Cook the planet, they saw Anthony muster all his well-known courage under fire and sink Plibersunk. But this week, Murray was in Western Troubler Wazi consulting with the great resource pollution giants and guaranteeing them and Roger his bill would strike a balance between their corporate interests and their corporate interests, would create an independent EPA other than giving the minister, i.e. Murray, the power to overrule it if they get it wrong, like oppose a resource development on flimsy grounds like environmental damage, and is considering preventing third parties like long-haired commie greenie wooden working and iron environmentalist Bob Brown, for instance, and affected parties from taking legal action. Thus, how could Bob Brown possibly see Murray as a corporate lackey? It is tragic, Brown claimed. Tragic, what nonsense. It is tragic that the big supremo has appointed a corporate lackey as environment supremo. We will take them on in the defence of the many heirloom creatures they are pushing toward extinction. By the way, Bob did use the words environmental supremo. Perhaps he's our listener. Murray also dropped into South Troubler Wazi to enjoy the sight of algal blooming and marine life destruction, finally meeting a group of concerned marine scientists a mere 2 years after they raised their concerns and sought a meeting about the then-looming problem with Tania, who, like Murray 6 months ago, also ignored them. Given they reckon climate change, if there is such a thing, could have a bit to do with it, we can be sure Murray will be reviewing his support for the fossil expansions, including those Western Troubler Wazi fossils he also met. Interesting question. Which group will have the biggest influence on the minister for the environment? That's four. Despite the bloom killing tens of thousands of creatures and degrading an estimated 400 species, Murray says it does not qualify to be declared a national disaster, leaving the mind to boggle at how much worse it has to get. Oh, and he will expedite an expert assessment to understand whether any local flora and fauna need to be added to the threatened species list. Nothing like locking the stable door after. As the Witch Bank, which used to be our bank, announced a record $10.25 billion profit, what excitement and what benefits for all of us. And its supremo, Matt My Commonwealth, said he knew people are doing it tough. That is, other people are doing it tough. And what about are you going to do about it, Matt? I've just done it. I admit I know people are doing it tough. As Matt joined the corporate sector, the very lifeblood of our economy, forget the blood of the working class, what would they know, in calling for the Socialist Talk Fest this week to address important issues like how the corporate sector can make even bigger killings, including, they say, light-touch regulations on AI, thus making a not-so-light-touch killing on the environment. And in one of the more perceptive observations, one corporate attendee hoped the Talk Fest would not get bogged down with sundry participants all prosecuting their own agenda. Does anyone seriously think they won't? Good luck with that. But don't worry, listener, something tells me capitalism won't be under threat. Western True Blue Aussie to South True Blue Aussie and now Perth to Canberra as the Julie Bash Up the Workers saga at ANU continues. Her Chancellor's office and staff in a Perth high-rise tower costing ANU a mint. And this week a board member telling a Senate inquiry Julie threw what the board member says were false accusations at her and then laughed and blocked her exit when she burst into tears, telling the inquiry she became suicidal and had a miscarriage. Nothing funny in this item, as Green Senator Maureen Farrughi told the woman, Dr. Liz Allen, there is no other pathway but for Julie and her co-conspirator, Vice-Chancellor Genevieve Bell, to resign. Just the level of trauma, intimidation, bullying and gaslighting that you have been put through is unbearable, she said. But at least Julie gets marks for consistency. And more cuts. The music school this week announced it will abandon its highly regarded teaching of instruments, of actually playing music. Know all about it, but can't play it. Brilliant. Meanwhile, US of the UN, of the US of the world, big supremo Donald Trump of the poor, has sent the National Guard in to save Washington. Great satirist Tom Lehrer, who died last week, wrote the wonderful Send in the Marines as the solution to all problems. Well, this is Donald's version. Cleaning up crime, although his claims it is out of control, don't accord with the actual falling crime rate, showing a yet another statistician should get the chop. As the Don contemplates sending the National Guard into lots of Democrat-majority cities, knowing they are all rife with crime and homelessness. And he said he would solve the homeless problem with his renowned compassion. The homeless have to move out immediately, immediately in huge capitals, sweep them off the streets to wind up. Well, what's it matter? At least they're not polluting the crime-ridden streets, as finally he promised there will be no Mr. Nice Guy. Also in big capitals, no Mr. Nice Guy. We want our capital back. Didn't say from where, but no Mr. Nice Guy. Just when we were warming to his intelligence, compassion and humility. Good afternoon.
Friends of 3CR, Les Thomas and Kavisha Mazzella, are joining forces for a powerful Gaza music fundraiser and to launch The Firing Line, their stirring anthem against genocide. After a shock venue cancellation, they found a new home at the Curtin Hotel, opposite Trades Hall on Lygon Street in Carlton. Join them 3pm on Sunday, August 31. Book now through Austix or the John Curtin website. Every ticket helps get vital support to those who need it most in Gaza. A 3CR supporter.
Out there on the firing line, see the faces left behind.
Early in July, Australian activist for Palestine Rob Martin left Australia to join 20 other activists to be part of the latest Free Palestine flotilla boat, the Handala, for its journey to Gaza to deliver humanitarian goods. The boat left Sicily on the 13th of July and travelled toward Gaza. On the 27th of July, the boat was intercepted by the Israeli Navy in international waters. Those on board taken to Israel, where they were detained in the Given prison in Ramla, central Israel, and later deported, although some remained in detention on hunger strikes. I spoke to Rob after a period of recovery from the ordeal in the prison, mentioned that he'd been an outspoken activist for Palestine for many years, including previous attempts to gain access to Gaza and deliver aid, but he had been to the West Bank a number of times and experienced life under occupation by Israel, and asked him first, when was the first time he went to the West Bank?
The West Bank, I went the first time in 2014. I decided to go and have a look. In fact, I had believed everything I had seen and read. And 2014, which was Operation Cast Lead, which is basically what we're going through now, but a smaller version, basically what Israel does. They've coined a term themselves, mowing the lawns. So when I went over there, I saw horrible treatment of the Palestinians, and apartheid was definitely a word that would explain it.
And the second time?
2017, 2018, I always get confused. I actually think it was 2017. I went back because I realised that I needed to see more and I wanted to catch up with some of my Palestinian friends. And I also went to travel with Miko Peled, who is a famous author for The General's Son. He grew up in a Zionist household and a very, very well-known military background. And I knew that he could take me places that other people couldn't. When I went to Hebron or Al-Kahil, it was an area that, it was clear that the Palestinians couldn't go on a bus. They couldn't go past an imaginary line that was there. The soldiers saw the Palestinians every single day, the same soldiers, but they harassed them, asked for their IDs, wouldn't let them go. I then also saw Israelis running down with their white shirts on and their chino pants, and they were training and they had M16s on their back, which to me was a very, very threatening look. And everything they do is to try and intimidate the Palestinians.
Well, that was your last trip, but in the meantime, between then and now, you were on a flotilla.
Jen, I've been trying to get on the flotilla for a while, and I think a lot of people don't realise that the Freedom Flotilla Coalition has been around since 2008 or 2007. They've been trying to break the illegal siege of Gaza ever since Israel put the illegal siege of Gaza on. I was supposed to go in about 2017. I was also supposed to go last year on the same boat that I went to on this, the Handala, but I was unwell and I couldn't make it. There was another ship called the Conscience that was bombed just outside Malta waters. And a lot of people aren't talking about that. And I don't understand why, because Israel bombed a Freedom Flotilla just off the coast of another country and nothing has happened. I mean, it's attempted murder. And then the Madeleine I was supposed to go on, but I was unwell again. And then the Freedom Flotilla for the Handala came around and I was on it. And I've literally only got back a few weeks ago.
Well, from your past experiences, Rob, how did you prepare for this latest one?
Well, it's an interesting one because, look, I don't do boats. Well, I'm not a boat person. But also you don't know what to expect with the Israelis. And so, look, I had training a year ago and again this year trying to prepare for anything that they can throw at us. I mean, Israel executed 10 activists in 2010. On a ship called the Mavi Marmara. They actually executed these people. They were found that it was unequivocally executing, but nothing has happened to the people that carried out those executions. And so I went on this ship knowing that anything could happen, that there were no bets off the table, that also we could potentially get killed, we could get beaten, we could get lost in the jail system of Israel because they are a law unto themselves. But 21 of us got onto the boat, the Handala. We had child formula, baby formula. We had stuffed animals with the teddy bears. We had food and medication. And we decided that what we needed to do was to go to Gaza and help feed and help the starving Palestinian children.
Had you met any of these other actors before?
Yeah, I have. So Tan Safi, I know quite well. Only superficially, like Tiago, who is a fantastic person. He's on the organising committee. And so I had met a few of them before, but got to really know them on the boat. Tan is Palestinian-Lebanese with a tiny bit of Australian in there, I think. She's been doing a lot of the videoing on the boats, and she's an acclaimed award-winning journalist part of what the Freedom Flotilla needed was exposure. It needed people to see what was happening to make sure that we were safe. You know, the more eyeballs on us, the safer we were. We had Vigdis. I was her kitchen hand. She's a 70-year-old grandmother that we've all adopted. She, in fact, was thrown in solitary confinement. This is how bad the Israelis are. So she was thrown in solitary confinement for a little while. There was a French politician. She was on there. There was a young lady who was working at the UN and decided to leave because she wasn't happy with what the UN was doing and wasn't doing enough of. And they also tried to stop her doing what she wanted. We had Chris Smalls, who took on and created a union against Amazon boss, and he won. So he's a very outspoken activist as well. And then we had Jacob Berger, who is he's a comedy. He's been in a lot of movies. He's an entertainer with a big following. And so he came on as well. And being Jewish, he could push some boundaries as well. And, you know, it was a good mix.
Well, you got on the boat and you left from Sicily. How far did you get before you were intercepted? And did you know where you were when they boarded the boat?
Yes, I think we're about 60 kilometres out. We knew they were coming. But so from Gallipoli, we'd spent 8 or 9 days at sea. So it's not an easy trip across the Mediterranean. And the Mediterranean is a very dangerous body of water. The boat that we had was made in 1968, so it doesn't go very fast, 5 or 6 knots at the maximum. We knew that they were getting ready because they had a drone above us that was stationary for quite some time. And we know what they're doing when they're there. They're basically getting the schematics of the boat to see how they can board it the easiest, see who's on there, take the pictures. And so we knew that that night was coming. We also know that they only come at night. And the way we had timed the trip was that we were getting closer during the day. And in the evenings is the only time they'll come and kidnap you. We were pretty close to Gaza at that stage. And so we're all getting pretty excited. But we were still in international waters. We saw a couple of flares go into the sky. The sky started to get a little bit hazy and a bit ghost-like. And then these boats appeared out of nowhere up the side of us, saying that this is the Israeli people, the Israeli kidnappers is what they should have said. They understand that we've had a tough 8 to 9 days travel. It's time. The journey's going to end. They will be boarding our boat in 10 minutes. And then they boarded immediately. So it was pretty quick. They were reasonably polite, but very threatening and intimidating. I mean, they had M16s, they had sidearms and all of these different things that they can use. And the boat is very, very small. And before we knew it, there would have been 20-something of these elite soldiers. This particular group called the Something 13, they are the most elite of all of them. They have to sign up for 5 years, unlike every other division within the Israeli army. Only have to sign up for 3. And so these guys, they're very agile. They boarded the boat without difficulty. They were very polite. They had a camera crew with them to start with. And then they looked for our cameras and then they ripped the cameras out very aggressively. They took all of our communications off and then they started to be a little bit more intimidating. They come on with riot gear. So they've got a lot of riot gear, fully decked out in their riot gear. And as I said, you know, some of them, they've got, you know, they've got the handguns, pistols, the M16s, batons. They can stand awfully close to you. They can look down at you. They got the upper position to make sure they were all looking down. Some of them had their guns out. There is a photo that was taken from our cameras before they pulled them down. And there was one of the soldiers pointing the gun at all of us. They can be a little bit sneaky the way they do that. They're petrified of anybody that supports Palestine. They're petrified of Palestinians. They don't want any food getting in there, but they're trying to protect their PR war as well. And that's another pretty important thing that they're trying to do these days.
What were you told they were going to do with you and your boat?
Well, they said they're going to take us to Ashdod, which is where, you know, where people go that have... Where all the boats are and where immigration is. We did that. They offered us food to try, you know, we told them we're not eating and they kept trying to do those things, trying to act nicely. In fact, they took my bag. I had a bag around my neck and it had my medication in it. And they said, give me a bag. And I said, no, I'm not giving you my bag because it's got my medication in it. And then that particular soldier said, okay, you keep it. 20 minutes later, another soldier came up and said, give me a bag. I said, no, I'm not giving you my bag. He tried to pull it off me, and I said, mate, I'm going with the bag. Because, Jan, I tell you, I didn't trust them. And I had also seen them bring on a bag that was clunking around. It was like a nylon bag, like a shopping bag, clunking. I don't know what was in it, whether it was knives, whether it was spoons. I don't know, because they never showed us. But what they did do is they carried that around the boat. I was concerned that they were going to plant things in my bag. They had taken other people's bags, you know, like the bum bags. That style is what they were collecting. And then one soldier, he said I could go with my bag. It was going upstairs. I said, right, I'll come with it then. And then as soon as he passed it on to go upstairs, he stood in front of me and wouldn't let me move forward. And to this day, I don't know what happened to that particular bag.
How long did it take you to get to the port?
We think it took about 11 hours. We're a little bit surprised. A few of us have discussed it that everybody fell asleep except for me. We're wondering whether or not that they part of the mist that we saw in the air was a sleeping thing to help people go to sleep or knock them out. I am on certain medications that can inhibit certain things for me. That's why we're wondering whether or not I was the only one awake. They did look very suspicious. Everything that they were doing, they were handing bags around, going up and down. It just didn't look right what they were doing. They didn't like the fact that I was still watching them, because the Handala is a very small boat and I was sort of in the middle deck and they were all up the top deck. They went through the front part with the engine. There's no reason why somebody would want to go in there for so long. They were in there for so long. So we wondered whether or not they were planting things in there as well, and other parts of the boat as well. And you know what? I've just remembered something, Jan. I remember when I was awake and they were being a little bit suspicious, there was maybe half a dozen, maybe a little bit more soldiers in the gully. That area is extremely hot. There was no air and they closed the door and they had their gear on. And I'm now wondering whether or not they were taking time out whilst we were breathing in the gas. I think that's probably what's happened. Well, I need to make sure that I write that one down. It's funny, things come to you as you discuss it. They took us to Ashdod. They said that we're going to hand you over to a different division. You won't be dealing with us anymore. What you've done is wrong. You'll be going to prison. We don't know what's going to happen to you. Things like that is what they said until we pulled up at Ashdod. We also realized that there had been about 10 to 14 boats that were around us that time, including some boats that have cannons on them. And anybody that's watched Gaza, where the Israelis shoot the Palestinians in the water with these rather big cannons, it was those boats that were around us. Yeah, so they obviously really thought we were a threat or wanted to give that appearance.
What was the prison like and how did you get there?
Horrific. Before the prison, though, I'll tell you, Jan, so these Elite 13 people, they're built for speed. So they're not big, they're agile. The next crew that was waiting for us, and there was a lot of them waiting for us at Ashdod, they were built differently. They were built like people that live in the gym. They were built for intimidation and all of those things. And they manhandled us as they took us into a room. Chris Smalls, who was the only black man on the boat, they beat him quite badly. They took him away from us because we'd all made a pact that we wouldn't be separated. But they took him away, so we were quite concerned. They strip searched us. They went through our bags very aggressively. They looked like they were treating people that had that were war criminals, like we were war criminals. They asked a few of us, including me, why do you care so much about the Palestinians? Why don't you go to Syria? Why don't you do that? Why don't you do this? It's though that, you know, we had really just, how dare we want to help the Palestinians? It really affronted them. They took all of our Palestine shirts, paraphernalia. They took a necklace of mine that had the map of Palestine on it. They took all of our pro-Palestinian attire. And then they noticed that I had about 15 pro-Palestine tattoos on my arms and neck, which they couldn't cover up. They were really upset by that. It really annoyed them. I think they were looking for ways to cover them up, but it's just impossible. Kind of funny.
Someone told me that the treatment you all got was colour-coded.
But absolutely. So Tan, who is an Arab, an Aussie Arab, she was dehumanised. Yes, she was intimidated. She was roughed up. She was beaten. They tried to take her nose ring out with massive fires, which, is just crazy. And this was in front of four or five other ladies who were all white. You know, some prisons, what they'll do is they'll do the respect of trying to beat you up privately. But here they did it in front of these other women. So they knew that what was going to happen, who's going to hold them to account. Personally, I think that the treatment would have been worse if Tan didn't have an Aussie passport. Things would have got a whole lot worse.
But Chris didn't go too well, did he?
No, Chris didn't. I was behind him when he was getting hauled into interrogation. There was eight of them. I think there was eight people. They just picked him up, made it look easy. So you'd have one particular person lift one hand and bend the wrist, like almost to breaking it. So he had one person on each hand. He then had another person in the elbow or the shoulder, and then the ankles and the knees. It was a very professional, well-practiced thing. And so he looked like he was in a lot of pain. And then we didn't see him for a few hours, but we knew what was going on.
And Chris is a Black American.
Yeah, he is.
So you believe that he got that treatment because that he was a Black American?
We can just look at the facts. The two dark-skinned people got beaten and the rest didn't. You can, anyone, your listeners can make that that judgment, but I think we're all smart enough to know.
How long did they keep you in custody, and what was it like in custody? Were you then separated? You said one woman spent a while in solitary confinement. What was confinement? Where were you? Was it inside a prison where other Palestinian maybe prisoners were also being kept?
Yeah, we were. So we were in another prison about an hour out of Ashdod, and there were permanent prisoners in there as well. We heard them. We heard some things that was not nice. You could hear people yelling and screaming and all sorts of different things. This particular part of the prison was where we were the only ones, though. And when I say the only ones, I'm talking two cells away, that separated us. Chris and the Americans, they were all in one cell. There were seven of them in one cell. And I was in a cell with one other, and we're still trying to figure out why he and I were put in a cell, other than the fact that he had a ban and I had a ban originally from Israel. And so we're still not sure about that. The trip from Ashdod to the prison was crazy. I was in the very, very front. The windows were painted, so you could see just tiny little bits throughout, and I could see that we had a police escort, four cars, police escorting the two vans, which, again, I think gives all of the look that we're very dangerous criminals, and anybody that sees us going in there must, tell other people, oh my God, they're dangerous. They drive crazily stupid because they want you to bang and knock your head and, hit each other in the back. The airflow is non-existent. And so it's very, very unpleasant. When we got to the prison, they took us out. They put all the boys in one part and then the girls in another. They then asked who needed medical help. I said, I need medication. So they took me out into this room. I would have had 15 soldiers around me, like in a small room. It just looked outrageous. Just so ludicrous. It wasn't funny. Someone asked me about what medication I needed. And look, I started to say, and they said, hang on. Stop. A cameraman came in, the doctor got on one knee and started asking me questions. And I said, seriously, what the hell are you doing here, mate? You're like an extra in a movie. And Jan, he wasn't the doctor. He was like an extra in a movie. They just wanted him with his jacket. He had a high-vis doctor thing on. Once he had done what he needed to do, which was to get in the movie, he left. And then the doctor started talking to me, a female. But she only asked, are you on medication? I said, yes. And then she said, okay. I said, you don't want to know what the medication is? And that was that. So it was like a circus. It's hilarious. If you weren't living it at the time, it would be funny.
Just over these hours and days it became, what were the thoughts that were going through your mind? How are you going to get out? What's going to happen to you? You're thinking about your family, you're thinking about home, you're thinking about the Palestinians.
You're thinking about all of that. You are thinking about all of that. You think about your family and you think, you know, geez, I wouldn't mind something to eat or something decent to drink or what's going to happen from now. And then you think about, you know, the whole trip that you've been on, the 10 days to get to Gaza and then being, you know, kidnapped, put in a prison. It gives you some reality of what the Palestinians go through. We've got an A-class passport. And so, you know, they have to be reasonably careful with us, supposedly. Didn't stop them. You were thinking, how long have we been here? Because you couldn't tell. They wouldn't really give you the time. Or if they did, it would be wrong. Because I asked two people and they both gave me completely different hours. We didn't have any yard time at all. We weren't allowed outside. So that makes it harder. The bed bugs were horrible. I reckon I didn't sleep for 3 out of 4 or 4 out of 5 days because I was kind of singled out a few times amongst conversations saying, this is Robert, he's going to be in big trouble because, you know, I had a band and they knew me from my activism. And so they tried to intimidate me in that way, saying that something might happen. So basically I stayed awake and I was, you know, standing up the whole time. Because I didn't want to. Not that there's anything I could have done if they decided to come in and beat me, but they did come in and strip search. They come in again with all of their outfit on, their riot gear and all of that to intimidate you, and they throw you into the shower and make you take all your clothes off, not knowing when that's going to happen or if it's going to happen again. That is always not easy to deal with. The embassy was very good. They did come to Ashdod, so I knew that I was going to be looked after. And then they did come to the prison, which I also was very thankful for. I can't deny them that positive feedback because they did do well. They couldn't get anything that I needed, though. Like, they wanted me to be able to at least get out and get some sunshine, have my medication. All of my phone calls, because they had denied us all of these things, it all fell on deaf ears.
It's ironic, Rob, isn't it? Because you've got a ban on being in Israel, yet here you are in Israel against your will.
Yes. And so part of the court case, I mean, look, we had a court case. You know, it's a kangaroo court. They know what they're going to do. There's no shadiness of what's going on. It is literally a kangaroo court. They wanted us out of that country as fast as possible. That's what they wanted. They just don't want us there. They tried to get us to leave, and we refused the first at Ashdod. The embassy said, do you want to leave? You can leave now. They will. If you sign this, you can fly out from Ben Gurion. And I said, no, I'm not signing anything. And we all said we're not signing anything because what they wanted us to sign was the fact that we had got into Israel illegally. And that they were deporting us. Now, we didn't want to give them that power. So we said, no, we will not be signing that. We've been taken here against our will. We have been kidnapped. And we demand that you put us back on our boat and we'll go to Gaza. That we weren't going to leave other than that. So we weren't signing anything. So part of telling the embassy that, they said, okay, so we go back into the prison. We did have a court case, and the court case said that none of us want to be in Israel. We've been brought here against our will. We want to go to Palestine. What you're doing is illegal. And so that's all on file. The solicitors said all of that, which I think is really important because it makes a big difference. If we had signed the form stating that we were okay, that we had illegally entered Israel, it would look different on our file. But you and I both know, Jan, it's going to make no difference, don't we?
Were you all released at the same time?
No, we weren't. And they didn't want us to go. So they come and they play funny buggers a little bit. They say, oh, because, you know, none of us were drinking or eating. They'd come up and say, oh, look, Chris, he drank some water and had a sandwich. Do you want one? They just want to try and break you down. And we knew that there's no way in the world Chris is going to do that. No way. So we were very closely bonded. We knew each other pretty well. We knew our strengths and we knew that we would do it for each other and also for the Palestinians. And as part of our training, we actually spoke about all of this and all of the things that we would do. So I think I, in fact, was released the first, which surprised me, but I believe I was the first, and Tan.
Do you know what's happened to the others?
They're all home. We're going to have a signal group, I think, early next week to sort of have a bit of a, you know, a breakdown and see how everyone's going and catch up. And because I know that, look, some aren't doing well, to be honest. Some are not doing well. Some are really struggling. It's tough when you see that, you know, everybody deals with things differently. Everyone goes into it with different issues as well. But as long as we're all there for each other, you deal with Palestine a lot, Jan, and you know, it's a very, very tough thing. You ask any Palestine activist, how are you going? They're not doing well because, I mean, look, they're just killing Palestinians and Israel's doing what they want. And, you know, we've been talking about it for years. It's scary. I mean, the fact that we have to keep talking about it. I'm speaking on Sunday at the rally, and I'm going to bring some of the paperwork that I started reading back in 2014. It's all exactly the same stuff. It's not really anything new. It's the same rhetoric. It's just a different number. And Israel has been pushing the Palestinians into a position where they pop so they can do this. We all have to do what we can do. And, you know, there's a new flotilla, the Samud flotilla. Hopefully they'll do some great work. That's what we're hoping for. They'll get a lot of boats out there. That would be good. We've all got to do what we've got to do.
And how are you feeling, Rob, now?
I'm all right. I get tired pretty quickly, which is interesting. So I'm trying. In fact, I should I didn't mention that Tan and I, we went to hospital in Jordan. So when we got kicked out through Allenby Bridge, they kicked us to Jordan and the Australian embassy took us to hospital and they deemed us unfit to fly.
Because of what?
Dehydration. And look, Tan was in a bad state because they sort of beaten on her. And flying to Australia from anywhere is not easy. It's a long way. And so they said, no, you need to spend a night in the hospital and we'll get your fluids up and we'll, you know, hopefully get everything, you know, back to as much as we can before you go home. You know, there, a lot of them are struggling. And it's sort of, you know, you come back and then you realise that there's not a lot we can do. We did a 10-day trip and it gets taken over so easily by a country that is genocidal. And sometimes it makes you feel helpless. And
I'm sure, Rob, that your Palestinian friends here in Australia and in Palestine are very proud of you.
Oh, they are, yeah. And that's always nice. But, you know, what was nice, we did get a lot of messages from Gaza. We did actually get a lot of messages from Gaza.
Good.
But then you hear, you know, they're all coming out. They'll be out to the ocean to see you. They'll go to the beach. But what I think it also does, and look, the main reasons we did it, one is to expose Israel's illegal siege of Gaza. That is the most important thing that we needed to show. We need to expose it. It's been going on since 2005. It's not new. New to what's going on because of October 7, assume that it's new. And they say, well, why would you be trying to break the siege now? It's a war zone. Well, in 2005, they put the siege on and they've never let it go. Never let it go. They've been killing these Palestinians in Gaza ever since. They've been sending flotillas. This was the 37th flotilla. But because of the timing, because of Greta, because of October 7 and all of those things, people have seen this boat. And people are saying, well, you know, it's a, why would you do this? It's, you know, not going to do anything. Well, it did a lot. It opened a lot of eyeballs. And I can tell you, there's more boats going very soon. So.
And the fact that they have on those boats activists from many countries around the world.
Yeah, so that's done for a reason. And the reason is protection. What you do want, and it's in fact unusual that they had so many Americans on board. It was a different tact. Normally what you want is you want as many countries as you can. So if you've got 21 people, you want to try and have 18 countries or 12 countries at least. Because what happens is that country has to get their one person out and it hits their news in their countries and the people speak up saying, hey, you need to get Jan out of prison. She's an Australian. She's legally been abducted and Israel is holding her illegally. And it makes it a lot safer as well. There's a lot that goes into it. It's not a matter of just buying a boat and sailing either.
Well, all I can say at the end of all this, Rob, is you do a great job and we're all grateful for what you do. And probably a lot of us wish we could do it as well, but we've got you there doing it for us.
Well, we will do. I was going to say that a lot of people did ask me why I did it. My answer is pretty simple. I was given an opportunity. For whatever the reasons, I was given the opportunity. I couldn't possibly say no. And then I couldn't, and people said, what do you tell your kids? I couldn't tell my kids that I had an opportunity to make a difference, and I decided not to do it. What sort of a role model would that be? And so that's why there was no doubt that I was ever going to be on that boat.
And I've been speaking with Rob Martin back home after spending time in an Israeli jail.
The war on Palestine has not stopped. Palestinians need self-determination. Gaza must be free of Israeli occupation forces, have unconditional access to aid and reconstruction. 17 years of Israeli siege must end.
The West Bank needs the violence and attacks by the Israeli army and settlers to stop, and an end to the occupation and apartheid.
Your support to end the war on Gaza to bring peace, justice and freedom to all of Palestine is needed more than ever.
Join the nationwide rally on Sunday, the 24th of August, 12 noon, outside the State Library Victoria on Swanson Street.
With Netanyahu and Trump threatening to ethnically cleanse Gaza and annex the West Bank, we all need to stand up and say no.
Nationwide rally, Sunday, 24th of August, midday at the State Library.
With your support, Palestine will be free, from the river to the sea.
Free Palestine Melbourne is a 3CR supporter.
After his belated decision to recognise the state of Palestine, Prime Minister Albanese has removed himself from his uncomfortable position, fence-sitting. But as I said recently, he's still got a long way before he puts his feet firmly on the ground. There are still many challenges for the PM, but there are also opportunities for the Australian government. And former diplomat and member of Australians for War Powers Reform, Dr. Alison Brynoski, has a list of 11. Alison, before you go through these opportunities, what prompted you to put pen to paper on this issue?
Well, two reasons really, Jan. I had to give a talk at the Pacific Peace Conference in Brisbane on the 2nd of August, which was right in the middle of Talisman Sabre and all of that, the war games exercise off the coast. So they wanted something that was relevant to that. But at the same time, I was thinking, I do a lot of meetings like this and a lot of Zoom things and a lot of webinars. And time and again, people say, well, what can we do? They look at you sort of desperate for some advice. And I thought, well, this time I'll anticipate them saying, what can we do? And I'll tell them as many things as I can think of for them to do. So that's how that happened.
Well, you've certainly thought of a few, Alison. So up to you, off you go.
At the conference, I didn't go through all of them because I could see their eyes glazing when I said I had 11 points. I skipped a lot, but then I gave them the paper and they circulated it. And I've had some nice feedback on that. So that's encouraging. But basically, what I was looking at is how Australia needs to change its foreign and defence policies. At that point, we hadn't even had the Great March for Palestine across the bridge in Sydney, which took place the day after I got back. Oh, and the recognition or the announcement that Australia will recognise the state of Palestine. So it was almost as though the things that I wanted to happen started to happen practically at once afterwards, for which I don't claim any credit at all, but I think maybe the moment has been reached. We still have other moments, and that is what some of my other points are about. So mainly what I'm talking about is for Australia to stay out of foreign wars. I would prefer altogether, but certainly no wars of aggression and no wars that we are dragged into because of our American alliance. So having said that, then everything else flows from there. One of the things that drags us, could drag us into a war against China, is the presence of American bases on our Australian so-called sovereign soil. Getting rid of those is opportunity number two. Opportunity number three flows from that too. And that is that we really need to redefine Australia's approach to defence and to take back control of our own defence and indeed our own intelligence, because what we're doing is accepting what we are told time and time again by our Five Eyes partners, in particular the United States, and not questioning things and not saying we don't need this kind of advice because it's contrary to our national interests. Then following on from that is opportunity number four. In recent days, before the conference, we heard from the Prime Minister about how the Australian Labor movement has never followed the flags of other lands or patterned itself on the movements that originated in other places. That's exactly wrong. That's exactly what we have been doing ever since 1941, really, or in fact, even before, because then we were following the British flag. All we did was change the flag to the American flag, and that's what made us the deputy sheriff. And we aren't changing our ways to avoid what Penny Wong talked about, a region that operates by rules, standards and norms and isn't dominated by a single major power to suit its own interests. Well, that's exactly what we do have in our region, and that's something that we need to do. Thinking for ourselves is how I summarise that opportunity number four. Opportunity number five is very obvious, stopping our support of Israel and demanding that the US should also do that. And that, of course, took action just shortly after the conference, as I said, and getting in ahead of other countries as soon as we can to recognise the state of Palestine is opportunity number six. We have a major problem, though, with China, because the United States is gearing up, there is no clearer sign, gearing up for a war, which would be an aggressive war, I assume, against China. What I think as opportunity number seven is that Australia should make it clear to Washington that Australia, just like the United States, recognises that Taiwan is a province of China and that we are not interested in a war with China over Taiwan. Now, that is something on which I think Professor Hugh White and I have common cause and have often talked about every time I see him. For the last two or three years, we mention this to each other, and we both agree that we ought to be giving Washington advance notice, diplomatically and quietly if necessary, that Australia is not interested in a war in Taiwan. And if the United States is planning, calculating on having support from a loyal ally, then they should think again, because the Australian government is not interested in that. And of course, the United States recognises that Taiwan is a province of China too. That is the big one, I think, is opportunity number eight. Number nine goes to the question of sovereignty, which is something that Richard Miles mentioned, I think, probably two dozen times in public last year and quite a few times this year as well, even as he was pressing ahead with AUKUS, which actually betrays what remains of Australia's sovereignty. Joining the biggest, what Bob Carr has anticipated as the biggest anti-war movement in our history, is something that we need to do together with other countries. And that would be to oppose a war that arises out of AUKUS, but a war against China. The opportunity number 10 is something that I've wanted us to do myself for decades, and that is to spend more of our waking hours talking with our ASEAN and Pacific neighbours who face the same sorts of dilemmas as we do about their security and defence and alliances and so on. Although they have been smart enough, the ASEANs and most of the Pacific countries, to not have alliances because they realised when they founded ASEAN that great power rivalry in the region was what endangered them and that their alliances couldn't be relied upon to protect them anyway. So they decided to be a non-aligned movement. And I would like to see Australia spend a lot more time talking with them about how they've done that, talking about the strengths and weaknesses of such a position, thinking about how that applies to Australia, and then persuading the Australian people that non-alignment is actually the best way to keep our security and our sovereignty at the same time. I think probably I'll spend what remains of my life fighting to get this up. So that's number 10. Number 11 goes to another question which hasn't been very much discussed, and that is that quite recently the International Court of Justice ruled that states have an obligation to cut greenhouse gas emissions and that not doing that may violate international law. That is, greenhouse gas emissions endanger all of us. And if we don't do that, that could be a violation of international law. And countries that do it could be required to make reparations to other countries that are damaged by it. So you see how that affects Australia. And it also brings us right up front with our Pacific neighbours who are very concerned about greenhouse gas emissions. And it's something that we should be thinking about together with the fact that military operations like Talisman Sabre and all the stuff that we're doing with AUKUS, military operations are huge emitters of greenhouse gases. So not only do wars of aggression violate international law, they may, if we engage in them, expose our leaders who wage such wars to being charged with international criminal offences. That's something that I hope keeps them awake at night. In conclusion, I just come back to what all this amounts to. The obvious: get rid of alliances that don't protect us, adopt neutrality and non-alignment, armed or unarmed, and that means no foreign bases in Australia, including Pine Gap. And we remember, of course, that Malcolm Fraser wrote in his book in 2014, Dangerous Allies, about that, and saying that, in fact, the presence of US bases in Australia is what causes Australia the greatest danger, not any foreign enemy, but our own ally. That was what I said to them, and some of them seem to have been interested.
Do you think, in a sense, that the ALP is in government is out of its depth?
The leadership of the ALP, Miles and Albanese, don't have much of an instinct for foreign policy, I have to say. It's great that the Prime Minister has been persuaded at last to make this move, catching up with a number of other countries about recognition of Palestine. But they have, like all Australians and like both the major parties, have not had to think about foreign policy ever, really, not in the way I'm describing it, not in terms of really protecting our national interest and sovereignty. They've never had to think of it that way because there's always been a great and powerful friend, first the Brits and then the Americans. And what we're seeing now that I think is waking them up is that our American powerful friend is unreliable, not necessarily predictable at all, and that in such a situation, it is necessary for an Australian government to think clearly about our sovereignty and security in terms that they haven't been used to using. They haven't thought this way for a long time. And indeed, the advisors that they have haven't ever had to think about these things either. The way France, for instance, runs its foreign policy, or China, is so different. They actually think carefully about the national interest and they work out their own way of pursuing it, which is just what we should be doing. And we don't, because the thought pattern, the habit of that kind of thinking doesn't exist in Australia. It's that that needs to be built up. I mean, Penny Wong understands it, but she is totally loyal to Prime Minister Albanese. She has been moving step by tiny step towards this Palestinian recognition for at least 2.5 years. And she's only been able to do that. There must have been huge fights between her and Miles, because Miles is and the right wing generally, plus the coalition, are totally in favour of Israel. And Israel is breaking every international law in the book. And it's shameful for Australia to support that. But that's not the only thing. Miles talks, and his predecessors in the defence portfolio, talk about a war with China as if it's when, not if, and as if it's something that we ought to be welcoming and getting ready for as fast as we possibly can. If you want peace, you don't prepare for war. If you want peace, you prepare for peace, which is what diplomats do.
Alison, it's not just the advisers, it's the lobbyists in Canberra who are pushing the Labor Party.
Yes, you're quite right, they are, and they're very powerful and they're very well financed. As you know, every major weapons company has a branch office in Canberra, American and European. And they're very powerful because they, as I said, they've got lots of money and they've got lots of hardware to sell. And we on-sell it, bits of it at least, to Israel, which is in itself a war crime. And we ought not to be doing that. The International Court has determined that that has to stop. Australia hasn't stopped, nor have we stopped denying it, which is not true. For ministers to lie to the people about what we're exporting in terms of arms is disgraceful. The other thing about our weaponry is that with all of this stuff coming in with AUKUS into bases in the Northern Territory, both present and past, have not demanded clarity from the United States, whose weapons they are and whose bases, in fact, they are, to tell us what they've got or what they'll use them for. They don't tell us whether their B-52s come in with nuclear weapons or not, and if those weapons are in Australia, where they are kept and what they will be used for. And if they are used, will we be warned first and asked if nuclear weapons can be used from Australia? They belong to the United States, and you can bet your life the United States will do exactly what it wants. And unfortunately, although I've credited Penny Wong for having more understanding of foreign policy than some of her colleagues, she has said that we neither ask, we don't ask, and we don't expect to be told by the Americans what they've got and what they're going to do with it. And that, if you want us to be a sovereign, independent country, is not the way to go.
So they've got a fair way to go yet, haven't they?
Sure have.
And Dr. Alison Bronowski is a former Australian diplomat and member of Australians for War Powers Reform.
3CR, your station, your voice.
These weapons are pointed at all of us. Take it personally.
And we need to be standing with communities on the front lines and really amplifying their fight and their voices.
And fight this until Australia is no longer one of the leading weapons manufacturers.
3CR, your station, your voice.
For a number of years, I've been speaking monthly with Bob Phelps. Bob is the founder and executive director of the Gene Ethics Network, an Australian non-profit advocacy group for food, crops, animals, to be free of genetic manipulation. He is an educator and a campaigner in peace and environmental movements with 60 years of experience. In 2003, he was awarded a Federation Medal for services to the community. But today, instead of the usual format of Bob talking about increasing pressure to introduce more genetic engineering into our society, we hear from Bob about his life as an activist, when and where it all began, the people in his life along the way, and the victories and the challenges over many years. But it all began, Bob, back in New Zealand during World War II.
1944, shadow of the atomic bombs.
Were your parents political at all?
No, they weren't. They were pretty unpolitical, asleep at the wheel, I suppose, politically. Although later on, my mum did support the Labor Party.
Where were you in New Zealand?
100 kilometres from Wellington, which is the capital, of course. Everybody thinks Auckland is the capital, but it isn't. It's Wellington at the southern end of the North Island.
What was school like? And I dare say you went on to university?
Yeah, it was interesting. I was thinking about what school was like, and one particular incident, I suppose, that kind of spelt out in retrospect what my life's path might take was that I must have been about 8 or 10 years old when one of the teachers asked us what we most feared, and everybody went round talking about, crashing a car or losing their mum and dad, et cetera, et cetera. And I said that the Nazis might come back. And everybody laughed and thought that was rather far-fetched. And now we know, of course, that the Nazis never went away and have been around all this time. So,
where would you have got that from?
Well, I don't know. It's hard to say. I suppose the generation before me had been at the Second World War. You know, they defeated the Nazis, rah-rah, and I just felt that it wasn't over. I suppose the nuclear arms race had begun, the Cold War had begun, kids around the world were ducking and covering in case the nuclear weapon was fired. It must have got through to me that there were things going on that, although I didn't understand them yet, and they must have come to me as a kind of feeling of apprehension.
Did you have any idea what you would do when you left school?
Oh, look, I worked in retail for a couple of years and did various things before going to university as a mature age student when I was about 20, well, certainly in my 20s. I didn't go straight to uni. I didn't seem to be cut out for that. But I did go to Victoria University in Wellington and did a double degree in sociology and psychology and an honours degree in psychology. So I was at uni, but most of what I did at university was actually politics. The US war was on in Vietnam and Southeast Asia generally, and I got bitten by the politics bug. So I spent a lot of time not studying and a lot of time on the campus acting up, trying to encourage people to think about young New Zealanders being drawn into a war that we had no business being in.
Was it much of an issue at uni?
Well, I remember, again, one incident which stands out for me. You might recall the Kent State shootings when the National Guard and the USA shot students who were rallying in opposition to the war in Vietnam. And it was the last day of term, as it was then, not semester, the last day of term. I recall going into classes and trying to get the students to leave for the afternoon in recognition of what had happened at Kent State and being told we paid to be here and we want our lecture. We don't want to do any activism on the campus. So that was kind of the mood, I suppose, among most of the students. It epitomised sort of the inward-lookingness of New Zealand, and that's one of the reasons, I suppose, that when I graduated, I left New Zealand and came to Australia, which, unfortunately, is pretty much the same.
You came to Brisbane?
Well, I ended up in Brisbane. It was a bit weird. I landed in Sydney and went to find a place to stay, and there was a guy there who said, "Oh, I'm just down for a couple of weeks. You can go and use my room in Brisbane if you like." So I hitched a ride with a truck driver up to Brisbane and stayed there. In fact, he never came back to his room, and I inherited it. And yeah, stayed on in Brisbane for 8 years. Of course, it was Bjelke Petersen time. Along the way, started the campaign against nuclear power and worked as the coordinator of the Queensland Conservation Council, which was my first sort of real job there. I just wore myself out. Actually, by 1980, I had to leave for several years in Asia to kind of recover from my first round of burnout, which all young people should be warned about and guarded against if possible. It really is a pretty wearing experience to have burnout when you're young.
People talk about the Bjelke Petersen years in Queensland. We don't actually hear a lot of what it meant to people. Can you explain what it was like? You were there for a couple of years during that time.
Well, it was 8 years a very conservative government that had the law and order as its way of getting re-elected as needed, and just being as corrupt as all hell, really. We recall that Bjelke Petersen subsequently went on trial, and although he got off, the case against him really deserved to be heard, because I think the Indigenous communities of Queensland copped it hardest. The reaction of people like Dennis Walker, for instance, were to go with the Black Panthers, and that caused a lot of conflict. But we had established a campaign against nuclear power, and when we were denied street march permits to talk about the fact that uranium mining was going on in Queensland, of course, the issue very quickly became Bjelke Petersen's taking away the right to march. And for about 3 or 4 years, that became the sort of number one issue, and all the people who cared about marching for whatever cause sort of gathered around that. There were huge marches and lots of conflict with police, really Bjelke Petersen dined out on it. He'd started out casting a vote in favour of his own leadership when his party were tied, but then he got hold of power and really held on to it very strongly for a lot of years, and pursued that law and order agenda, of course, with the police commissioner who was a corrupt junior cop who got elevated to the top and really did the work of him and the other very, very conservative people in the cabinet at the time. So it was a very challenging and demanding time. Our houses were broken into and searched by the police when we weren't there. There were lots of jailings, of course, and people had said they would stay in jail or not give a recognizance so they could get out. And it really went on. The judiciary got very upset because they had to bring judges in from the country to deal with the number of people who were saying that they wanted to be heard in court as well. So it was very considerable forces arrayed against each other, but I think ultimately you'd have to say that the government had the police force and its own policies at its disposal. So the street march issue sort of took over from everything else, which was unfortunate because my main focus and concern throughout that period was about nuclear issues, about the mining of uranium. And of course, here, 40 or 50 years later, nuclear weapons and the major threat to the world, survival, actually, is still on the agenda, and the Australian government is still resisting doing what it should do, and that is sign onto the treaty which prohibit the nuclear weapons. The International Campaign Against Nuclear Weapons is now 20 years old and is having some success, but Australia is still hanging on to the US coattails and not signing on to the treaty, which is very unfortunate. I mean, that's a success story in that a small group of people here in Melbourne started that campaign, got the international treaty, and were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2017, and yet governments here still don't acknowledge the will of the people that we should try to abolish nuclear weapons from the world. So this is, of course, a replay of the themes that have gone through my life, being born in the shadow of the bomb, running the campaign against nuclear power in Brisbane for 6 or 7 years, and then being employed by the Conservation Foundation at one point on nuclear campaigning. Today, supporting the movement for the recognition of Indigenous Australians who were exposed to nuclear weapons tests and have never been compensated or had their health issues acknowledged as a result of those impacts, getting Australia to sign on to that treaty, which now has nearly 100 countries as signatories to it.
I'll take you back a bit, Bob. Your couple of years, you said, I think it was a couple of years in Asia. Where did you go and what did you think you were going to find there?
Well, I had a fascination with China and Asia generally since my youth. I grew up with a Chinese community in New Zealand, and it was a different culture. I liked the people, and I had this idea of finding out what China was about. And indeed, just after Mao died, I had the good fortune to go on a tour for several weeks of China at the invitation of their government. And that was a pretty affirming experience. So when I went back a bit later after the burnout time, I spent a lot of time in Taiwan, Hong Kong, toured mainland China a couple of times independently, and just, you know, soaked up that atmosphere and recovered enough to come back to Australia. And I went to film school. That's what brought me to Melbourne. And, you know, at the time I was interested in going into the film biz, but then I fell back into environmental campaigning at the Australian Conservation Foundation and found a mentor there. The director, Philip Toyne, sort of took me under his wing. And Midnight Oil came on board with some money to form a campaign around genetic engineering. And to my good fortune, I was appointed as the person to campaign on gene technology issues, which, of course, continues today.
What did you know about genetic engineering at that time?
Well, very little, but I was first given the job of surveying the membership of the Conservation Council to see whether others were as concerned as we were in the Secretariat about it, and found that, yes, a lot of members didn't know a great deal about it, but were concerned. And so when Midnight Oil was willing to give some money from the royalties from their album Species Deceases towards a campaign on genetic engineering, then I was ideally placed to do that. And in 1988, we began what became Gene Ethics, which is still going today.
How did you plan to go about it? Was there a plan?
Well, initially, it was very interesting. Like, within weeks of our starting at the beginning of 1988, Monsanto turned up. They were the main movers and shakers in the area of genetic engineering at the time, and they invited me to go to the USA, to Washington DC, for a conference, and then to go on to their world headquarters in St. Louis. And I guess their agenda was to convince us that really there was nothing to worry about and we should just let them get on with it. It was kind of an interesting trip. I slept through the conference because I had no experience of jet lag, and going from here directly to Washington and then into a conference, I was absolutely zonked. But I then, because of my interest in peace issues, I went to the third special session on disarmament at the United Nations, which was a very interesting experience. Then went on to the Monsanto World Headquarters, and by then I'd had a chance to talk to all the people who were campaigning around Washington especially, about what the real issues were. So I was pretty primed by the time I got to Monsanto, and, you know, what they didn't steamroll me. I came away convinced, really, that Monsanto was up to no good and that we would have to continue our campaign and hopefully defeat their nefarious plans and projects, which at that time was principally focused on an animal pharmaceutical, bovine growth hormone, which is not used in Australia at all, but has gone on in the USA, where they keep their dairy cows in confined facilities. They don't allow them to graze. A hormone that increases milk production, but of course it means that the cows wear out very much more quickly, and most of their cows are out of production and dead by the time they're about 4 years old, instead of the decade that is typical in Australia. So seeing that, I became very primed to follow Monsanto, and of course that culminated in the March Against Monsanto, huge demonstrations in the late 2010s, and following that, of course, Australia hasn't really picked up genetic engineering as was envisaged, and our attention now has gone on to the genetic engineering of other organisms than crop plants and animals out on farms. And we're much more focused now on human genetic engineering in the human health system, claiming to be to make people more healthy, but in fact mainly in service of the IVF industry, which is a huge multi-billion dollar industry now globally, in which human reproduction is managed.
You are listening to Tuesday Hometime on Melbourne Community Radio Station 3CR. My name is Jan Bartlett, and I'm speaking with Bob Phelps, the founder and executive director of the Gene Ethics Network. Could you give me a definition of genetic engineering?
Genetic engineering is a set of techniques and technologies for applying the principles of engineering, which is nuts and bolts, etc., to living systems, and particularly to cellular structures that contain DNA that are really the basis of life, that are the operating instructions for all living things. And those genetic engineering, or those engineering principles, of course, are very, very concrete, whereas when you're talking about engineering things within cells, which are microscopic and really mostly can only be seen through microscopes, very powerful ones, or inferred, which is still the case, then you're starting to create a whole new ball game. And of course, there's now a gigantic industry in which artificial intelligence, IT, nanotechnology, and a whole raft of other scientific pursuits are now converging on genetic engineering as well. So huge industries are being built, scientific careers and institutions like CSIRO are now heavily engaged in engineering living systems. And meanwhile, our living systems are collapsing around us as a result of environmental damage, global climate change, land clearing, pollution with plastics and a whole raft of other chemicals. So we've been living in the chemical age since the, really before the Second World War, but on steroids since the Second World War, when an industrial base of chemistry was built to fight the war. We've really shot ourselves in the foot seriously, and now to try to clean up the damage we've done, whether it's nuclear waste or plastic pollution or global climate change, is proving possibly to be on the capacities of humanity. And I foresee that quite soon we could see our own extinction. We're making extinct a lot of the other species on the planet, and we might be next.
You mentioned Toyn as a mentor back in the 80s, but in those following years and up to today, who have been your main mentors?
Oh, gosh. Just before we started this interview, in fact, I was watching Bernie Sanders talking to a town hall meeting in the USA. A third of the town turned out because people are starting to understand what Trump now has as an agenda. You know, I think the world has so changed since those early days with the internet and the web, and just enormous amounts of information about everything. that's where you find leadership, where you find inspiration. And it's a kind of a new ball game, really, and trying to create campaigns that will actually produce good results for humanity when you've got artificial intelligence and propaganda programs and billionaires in charge of, now clearly in charge of global agendas, you know, the corporations that were always there calling the shots, the fuel industries, etc. They still are running their agendas, and it's inspirational people like Bernie and some of his colleagues in the USA who are doing good work. Yeah, and I think we need to really question what's happening in Australia too, because, you know, the landslide that Albanese got at the last election has now turned into a backslide, so that we saw recently, for instance, that, the government was investing in public housing because we've got 120,000 people homeless in Australia, which is an absolute scandal because everybody has the right to a home. So what was their great project, which David Shoebridge in the Senate took them to task on a couple of weeks ago? They're building 700 houses for US military personnel in Western Australia under the AUKUS agreement. The AUKUS agreement, which ties us to the USA even longer, instead of recognising that we're actually living in the Pacific and Asia, and that we need to make good friends with our neighbours and not be looking to Mother England or Father USA under some imaginary nuclear weapons umbrella to rescue us if we get into trouble.
The Gene Ethics Network, where's that going, and who are the members of the Gene Ethic Network?
We're still jogging along. We're here since 1988. I talked a little bit about the founding of that, Midnight Oil, and then Nick Balkas, who was a senator from South Australia, was a mate of Philip Toynes, and we got money from the federal government to do education around genetic engineering for a number of years until the election of 67, when what's-his-name was elected. Of course, the money was chopped off straight away, so we had to become independent. And then I stayed on board under the ACF umbrella, even though the money had run out for 7 years, actually, running Gene Ethics as a volunteer and doing a bit of work on the side to stay alive. And then we formed Gene Ethics as a company limited by guarantee in 2003. And more recently, the Australian not-for-profit commission, we joined up with them, and we got tax deductibility last year, finally, after it being on the Minister of Environment's desk for a number of years, unapproved. Gene Ethics is still going. Its corresponding membership or constituency is around 13,000 people. We just keep pumping out information and trying to run campaigns around what science and corporations are proposing. But the technology really is now being applied in so many areas of industry and commerce that keeping track of it and trying to run campaigns is increasingly difficult with a small staff and a small core of really interested people, but most of whom are great supporters for a very long time, but have their own lives, their own activities, their own concerns. Really, if you want to be successful politically because of the way the system is stacked against the community, you need to run a campaign about one issue for 10 years, I think, to actually win it. And it can take a lot longer than that, as I mentioned in the case of the nuclear weapons, which we began in the 1970s and is still now not won. So we're in a much more dangerous position from many, many new technologies, new revolutionary ideas. We have, for example, Elon Musk, who is the richest guy in the world, is also a transhumanist. So he's got a company and is very interested in how we get to Mars, sure, but also how we modify human beings to be more effective, more efficient. And this is coming into the whole area of eugenics, where you want to improve human beings the eugenics programs of the 20th century, of course, saw a huge number of women sterilized against their will because they were thought to be unfit to be mothers. It was run by people who were part of that ruling class, who were in the same or similar mold to Musk and his merry crew. And then since then, we've got IT and artificial intelligence. So Silicon Valley is very interested in manipulating living systems as well as storing data. We have, just to take one proposal for the moment, recently a citizens' jury, which we haven't got the results of yet, where a group of Australians were got together to discuss whether every infant that's born should have its genome sequenced. You might recall that every infant, or most infants, 99.9%, have a blood spot taken when they're born, and it's then tested for up to 25 different illnesses. At the moment, they restrain that to say these are illnesses that we could do something about, that we can prevent or cure. But now they're talking about using those blood spots to sequence the genetic information of every infant born and put it on file. An enormous amount of data, but also extremely intrusive. It just, for one thing, imagine that your DNA is on file and you want to get insurance. You're regarded as having certain pre-existing conditions because of your genetic makeup. There are a whole raft of questions that haven't yet been asked, let alone answered, about such a proposal, and yet it's got legs in the UK and now in Australia. There are some very worrying things going on behind the scenes that we are trying to get out into the public eye in order to warn people that these aspirations for a different kind of society, which has got even greater control over people's lives, is coming, I'd say.
What's your connection with similar networks in other countries?
Well, for example, we're a founding member of the Stop Designer Babies Coalition, which is international. We're also part of several corresponding lists which exchange information, and I'm sure many other people are like that as well. And we collaborate with scientists, lawyers, and activists in many countries. Recently, we've got very good support, for instance, on the proposal to release millions of genetically engineered mosquitoes in Queensland, which I think we've talked about before. And some of the most compelling contributions or submissions that were made to the regulator about that actually came from the USA as a result of our talking to people over there who have been working on mosquito issues, particularly in Florida, but also in other countries like Brazil and the Cayman Islands for the last 15 years. And their experience and information about this issue has gone into the regulator that hasn't yet made up a decision about whether or not the mosquitoes should be released. But we see on the other side a coalition of Oxitec, which is the corporation originated in the UK but now based in the USA, and CSIRO, our leading scientific research organisation, jointly making the submission and arguing the case for the mosquitoes to be let go, even though the public health and environmental issues haven't been discussed or resolved. We've been trying to gee up people, particularly in Queensland, which is where the first releases would be made, to see whether we could actually head this off. Interestingly, though, the Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority also needs to examine this particular proposal, along with the Federal Department of Environment. And we just had correspondence with the department, and they were saying, yes, we will be examining this particular proposal pretty carefully, and it could take up to 24 months. There's a window of opportunity there. Resources need to be put in. People need to be mobilised to say, we've already got a very good system of mosquito control in the north, which has been working very well and has knocked the incidence of dengue fever down to virtually zero over the last decade and a half. do we really need these other mosquitoes, which will have to be, through an unsustainable strategy, will have to be continuously released into the environment with unknown consequences. We need a debate. Generating that debate is another task, along with trying to talk about human genetic engineering, crop plants, and other things that are going on in various industries and in various places, with advocacy, very determined advocacy in Canberra, where lobbyists, some 750 lobbyists, really lead the government by the nose on every issue you can imagine, and where the public is not heard.
Well, all I can say to finish, Bob, is congratulations for wonderful work, and it's been great talking to you once a month for I've forgotten how many years.
Yes, well, thanks for doing it, Jan. I mean, you've been working on your program for countless years as well, and that's a great contribution to the community. I think 3CR and you and all the other people who give their time and energy and commitment to trying to talk to the world about what the real core issues in our society are and trying to do something about them do a great service as well. So lifelong activism, yes, that's what we need. People to be alert to what's going on, not asleep at the wheel. And wherever you can, even if you can't go to the rally or you can't do a lot of other things out in the world, then you can still write a letter. You can still call up politicians. You can complain. You can talk to your neighbours. You can defend those things that in our society are valuable. And I think we need to always stay at the core: health, education, food and housing. Those are core issues for the community, and our governments are letting us down. We have rights to housing. 120,000 people are homeless every night in Australia. Masses of people are dependent on food bank and other services in order to put food on the table for their kids. And now that higher education is so expensive, whereas it was free for us, things need to change there too. And in the health system, of course, the public health system needs to be favoured when a lot of the resources are being directed to private health provision, and the same with schools. The private school system, okay, it's fine, but it serves the elites, and the public health system suffers. And people who can't really afford it are having to pay squillions now just to put their kids through the public school, which ought to be free.
And you have been listening to the life and work of Bob Phelps, the founder and executive director of the Gene Ethnics Network.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast. Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
In Palestine, they're murdered. In Australia, attempts are made to silence them. I'm speaking in the first case of Palestine, where journalists, numbering now over 200, have been assassinated. In Australia, journalists are sacked, demoted, and in the case of one of Australia's most respected journalists, Mary Costakidis, facing a federal court case filed by the Zionist Federation of Australia, aimed at silencing her for speaking out about genocide in Gaza. We've all been urged to stand with Mary, and today I'm speaking with Peter Slezak, Honorary Associate Professor at UNSW. Peter, you've written that Mary's case is about the most fundamental issues of truth, justice and free speech in a decent society. and you give concrete examples of just these challenges in history. Can you explain those to us?
Thanks very much, Jen. Look, in my speech, I actually mentioned the famous cases, which are worth mentioning because they raised these issues and were kind of a permanent part of our Western tradition. I quote John Stuart Mill, who wrote an essay on liberty, a book, a short book, but one of the chapters is on the freedom of speech. And I quote him in there where he talks about the cases in history where he says that we commit these terrible crimes, which in later generations we look back on with horror, where we unjustly condemn people who deserve to be heard and were telling the truth. And he mentions, of course, Socrates, and in fact, Jesus. He mentions Jesus. So that's the classic source of the statement. And what's interesting about that particular statement is, and it's very important to mention this, that he argues that it's the most reviled and most hated speeches that we have to give the freedom to, because they're the ones that need to be protected, because even though they're against the majority opinion of people, they're the ones we have to recognize the importance of protecting them. And in fact, the Americans understand this because they've incorporated, of course, into their constitution, the First Amendment. And there's a famous case where the, in fact, Jewish head of the American Civil Liberties Association defended the right of Nazis to march in a Jewish town and a Jewish suburb somewhere. And that's the principle. And I can, as I always do, quote Noam Chomsky. He says, look, even Goebbels and Hitler believed in free speech for the views they agreed with. The whole point is to give free speech to the views we hate. And most people don't get that. I have arguments with colleagues about this where they think there's got to be limits to some views that are so hateful, but it's the hateful ones we have to protect. Well, anyway, I mention that because that's the context in which people ought to be allowed and protected for saying things which are unwelcome to authority. And of course, again, in history, the famous case, because I'm a philosopher, inevitably, I mention it, Socrates. And that's the famous example of someone who was put to death. And John Stuart Mill says that when the people put him to death, they were the decent people. They were the good people who had, he says, the values, the morality, principles that were admired in their time. This is the paradox, the irony. So it was the good people that killed Socrates. And he was, in retrospect, regarded as the hero of telling the truth and justice. And you know, the accusation against him was that he was corrupting the youth and not teaching the gods of the state. Well, that's a metaphor for not telling the official dogmas and doctrines that we're supposed to by our authorities. So those are the classic examples. And if inevitably, Mary's case raises all of these fundamental principles, and most people don't really understand how important they are.
What does that say about the rights here in Australia? Talk about America. What rights do we have here?
Well, we certainly don't have the First Amendment to the Constitution the way the American. We don't protect free speech in the same way. And perhaps the worst example of having abandoned that is that the universities gave up tenure some years ago. I wrote about this because tenure at universities was the most important protection for free speech, for academics to say unpopular things and to write things which are unwelcome. And now, I mean, in America too, tenure is protected. It's sacrosanct. Here, our own academics actually traded it in some years ago for a salary increment, which was an appalling mistake, because now, of course, academics who you might rely on to be fearless and speak freely and speak out contrary to what may be the more popular opinions, they're now clearly intimidated, and they're being sacked for asserting unpopular opinions. And we don't have anything like the First Amendment. And some views, let me mention one important example in relation to Mary and others. 18C, the Anti-Discrimination Act, 18C, is the one in which people are using to pursue people who offend, or whatever the wording is exactly, against some sort of racial or other behaviours. The trouble is that that's very problematic. And rather paradoxically or ironically, the one critic of the 18C was George Brandis when he was Attorney General. And he understood that, he said, you don't have a right not to be offended. That's not a right. People ought to have the right to say things even if you find them offensive. And I think he was right, and it was according to these principles that I'm talking about, the John Stuart Mill view, that even the most offensive principles, people shouldn't be able to litigate because they're offended. And people are offended for all sorts of reasons. And sometimes it's the truth that they're offended by, as often is the case nowadays.
Into this debate comes anti-Semitism.
Yes, of course. Well, yeah, that's a big topic, isn't it? And that's got out of hand. I'm up to my neck in trying to deal with this. Here in Australia, we've gone, well, not just in Australia, the IHRA definition has had this sort of extraordinary influence around the world.
Can you talk about how that came into being, that definition?
Yeah, there was a group, I can't remember the name, some association of people who tried to formulate, for various reasons, a definition of anti-Semitism to do with Holocaust denial. It's the Holocaust Remembrance Association, they're called. The actual founder or the director or the leading person in that actually was the most critical of the document or the final IHRA definition. He has been very outspoken, saying that the whole intention was never to suppress criticism of Israel, and the anti-Semitism definition is now used that way. It's been very severely criticized by leading jurists and scholars and academics around the world. In fact, about 200 or 300 Jewish experts on the Holocaust and anti-Semitism, they drafted an alternative, the Jerusalem Declaration of Anti-Semitism, which doesn't mention Israel. A formula somehow was like a virus. It got picked up by governments, our own government, and around the world in America. Maybe on the decent principle that they needed to act against what they thought was terrible racist prejudice, anti-Semitism, which it is. But they've overreacted to this. Now it's a repressive principle which now suppresses any criticism of Israel. Some of the principles, the examples that are always associated with the definition, for example, calling Israel a racist endeavor is one of the prohibitions or one of the violations of their rule. Well, I mean, it just is, objectively. Israel, you know, in 2018 passed a nation state law where it says Israel is the state of the Jewish people, not of its citizens. Well, I mean, you know, and there's endless other examples of racism. So these are objective facts which now become prosecutable under or charged as anti-Semitic. It's just outrageous and it's out of hand. Sadly, I'm afraid I have to say, the Palestinians themselves have been not too enthusiastic in promoting the JDA, which I think has been a mistake, I'm sorry to say. I think that's a problem because we have to push back with something. I mean, ideally, a lot of people correctly say we shouldn't have to have a definition because there's important principles that some universities have against any form of racism, and that's right. The trouble is that this is like a runaway train, and it's not good enough just to say we're not going to have any definition. It would be better to give people, like the Prime Minister, something to show his credentials and his virtue signaling and say, look, if you want really against anti-Semitism, take this one, the JDA, which doesn't mention Israel. Criticizing Israel, it can't be anti-Semitic unless in some cases it can be shown to be.
There are more Semites than there are Jewish people. That is never mentioned in any of the debates.
Well, look, that's right. I mean, the Arab people are Semitic, but that's a kind of anthropological point, which really, it's a bit of a distraction, I have to say, because we mean Jew when we talk about anti-Semitism. It's not about criticising other Semitic people, because the whole recent history of it anyway, it's come to mean Jews.
A definition of Zionism to bring into this conversation that fits with this issue of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, well, look, Zionism is a pernicious doctrine. It's been presented over years as some kind of benign ideal for a home for the Jewish people and all this. But its history, a sordid and ugly history of dispossession, of ethnic cleansing, of violence against the indigenous people, and this whole idea that it's some noble, even today people are saying, oh, it's just the wish for a home for the Jewish people. But as I wrote somewhere, yeah, it's a home for the Jewish people at the expense of kicking out the people whose home it was. It's stealing the home of another people. That's what it is. There's just no question about it. And the idea that maybe there were Jews there, you know, a couple of thousand years ago, I mean, that's just so absurd. The idea that people could take this seriously is just intellectually and morally really awful. I mean, it's like, so how many people would give their house back to an Aboriginal family that claimed that they were the rightful traditional owners of, I don't know, wherever people live today? None of the Jews, certainly, in wherever they live, would say, oh, yes, look, on that principle that we claim Palestine as our ancestral home, I better give my home back to the Aboriginal people that we stole it from, which we did. So, you know, it's a horrible inconsistency. There's a certain sense in which certainly what happened, and that's more recent, the tragedy, the genocide of indigenous people here is much more recent. It's ridiculous to talk about what happened in biblical history as though it gives Jews any rights. It's just absurd.
And, of course, Israeli leaders over the years have acknowledged what they've done to the Arab people living in that country. They've dispossessed them, they've killed them. They don't actually admit that they've killed them, but they admit that they've taken their land and they don't have the rights to it.
Yes, that's right. Look, what's interesting about that is that I'm often quoting in the speeches I give, the completely forthright, candid remarks of the founders of the Zionist project in Israel, Ben Gurion himself, Moshe Dayan. They all said we stole this land from people, and they didn't hide the reality. It's just become, you know, unfashionable today to admit to this crime, and so people pretend that it never happened. But that's why I always quote these people. You can hardly criticize them as being, I don't know, anti-Semitic or whatever you might say. These people just told the truth about what they were doing. People like Moshe Dayan, he's got a remark somewhere I quote. He says, every village that is now part of Israel had a different Arabic name because people lived there. Well, and that was, of course, before the 1948 Nakba, the catastrophe in which they destroyed 500 Palestinian villages. I mean, literally wiped them out. That's a horrible story. And the idea that Zionism is just this benign, noble ideal for a national self-determination of the Jewish people is just rubbish.
Well, let's talk about Mary for a little bit and the case that she's facing. Can you do that without subjudice or anything? Because it hasn't gone to court yet, has it?
Well, look, I'm not totally expert on the ins and outs of it. She's involved in this case, which essentially is raising her remarks that were made in a couple of posts online. She's been attacked for that. I don't think anything she said deserves to be criticised, for one thing. The whole point, I think, to make about that is they pick on Mary because she's such a prominent, famous and admired person in our society, and bringing her down would be a great victory symbolically. And, of course, the whole point of pursuing someone like Mary is to teach a lesson to shut everybody else up. If they can do this and cause enormous distraction and cost to somebody as high profile and as highly regarded, that just puts the wind up other people, rightly. I mean, it's a warning. And so that's why Mary's case is important, because for all the energy and time and effort that has to go into it, it's worth fighting just because, I mean, it was like the Latouf case with the ABC. These are important cases because of the principle involved. There have been other cases like that. I've been involved in expert witness for one person who was pursued for things that he'd posted. This is the battle that we have to fight here. And, of course, the point of it, the most important thing to say, I suppose, about these cases is that they're a distraction from the genocide, from the horrors, the crimes of the State of Israel. It's a way of diverting attention and resources and energy from paying attention to the horrors that are going on in Palestine. That's the main motivation.
And, of course, the main diversion of people away from the horrors of Palestine has been the deliberate killing of over 200 journalists in Gaza itself, so that you can't get the proper reporting except by Gazans who maybe have mobile phones, but no other journalists from overseas are allowed into. They've allowed a couple in now. You know, I can imagine they're following their every movement, but if you want to silence people, you kill the journalists.
Yes, look, it's been just horrible. Just in the last day, there's been an online statement made by, I don't know, a couple of dozen journalists calling out the names of all of the journalists that have been murdered. I mean, it's unprecedented numbers have been murdered. And just recently in one tent, I don't know, four or five were murdered. The saddest, awful, harrowing stories of these young people who were against an enormous difficulties and odds still trying to tell the story of the suffering there. And that was getting out, and it was having an impact, obviously, in the world. People are paying attention, or those that are can see what's going on. The videos, it's absolutely heartbreaking, harrowing stuff to see. And, of course, not accidentally, the Israelis want to make sure that people don't get to see it. It's a bit late, I mean, after all the realities. But, you know, it's amazing. I talk to people in the Jewish community. I don't know how they can see this to the extent that they do and be in denial about it or justify it. That's the difficulty we're facing. So the less information... Yeah, so the journalists have been particularly targeted. The extraordinary numbers are really bizarre, the extent to which they've clearly been targeted deliberately.
I don't know how you feel about it, but when I heard that Albanese had a chat with Netanyahu before he made his decision, how did that make you feel? Talking with Netanyahu.
Well, good. Where do I begin? It's rather ironic, though. You know, the rallies for Gaza, they always are very angry with Albanese for having done practically nothing, Albanese and Wong. But the irony is, you talk to people in the Jewish community, they're also angry with Albanese for the slightest, you know, token gesture that he makes to criticise Israel. So he loses on both sides, which is, you know, ironic. Albanese, I have to say, is, well, he's been referred to the International Criminal Court, for goodness sake. That tells you something. Their complicity, responsibility for what goes on can't be avoided, just apart from the fact that they've not been willing to say anything. And maybe the chat with Netanyahu is just, you know, inevitably a way of saving face. Or it's been extraordinary how little this government has done and waffled about it and then lied about their ridiculous claim that Penny Wong makes, that they didn't sell lethal parts. Well, David Shoebridge, to his great credit, said, which part of the F-35 is not lethal? I mean, that's where we're at with this government.
What do you believe will be the situation come September with the General Assembly meeting?
Well, look, you know, the business about recognising Palestine, it's quoting now the leading Palestinian spokesman that I'm following and close to. They're rightly angry about this. It's a little bit too late, for one thing, but it's a token gesture. At the time when there's a genocide, the statehood, declaring the statehood, is hardly the priority at the moment. I mean, you know, we're talking about the enormous numbers of people starving to death now. I mean, this is another gesture that the government makes, thinking that maybe it'll save its reputation in the eyes of the Palestinian people. After all, you know, the 300,000 that marched on the Harbour Bridge is a very significant proportion of the population and an indicator of the feelings. And maybe he thinks that this gesture will placate them or make them think that he's doing the right thing. And it's exactly the wrong thing to be doing at a time when concrete actions... Now, it's not that statehood isn't important, because it all is. The whole question of the statehood of Palestine. Firstly, Israel has made sure that there's no possibility of a state, and they've declared it explicitly. The charter of the Likud party says explicitly, this is Netanyahu's party, says there won't be a Palestinian state. And he said so repeatedly publicly. So now coming out with this gesture is completely empty. Why now? Why didn't he do this years ago when it was appropriate and before a genocide? So I think it's important to speed and reflect the feelings of the Palestinians, who are not impressed by this essentially empty gesture. I mean, because what can it achieve to stop the genocide?
Finally, Peter, as we speak, more people are dying. And it's not just the ones who are dying of hunger. There are bombings happening continually. And the story of taking over Gaza City and then shifting the people off to South Sudan, where a war is raging.
Yeah, it's horrendous. This whole thing is surreal. The most important thing it strikes me to say about is, how come there's not outrage and, you know, just uproar from people about the whole thing? This has been able to proceed with impunity because governments and the media have basically allowed it to happen. They can come up with these harebrained schemes, demolished literally, and the whole of Gaza is flattened. It looks like, you know, after a nuclear explosion, like after an atom bomb. Well, how has this been possible? That's the thing that you can't. So now they've got these harebrained schemes that are going to get rid of people. And I think they're emboldened to do this because what pushback has there been from anybody? Europeans, the Americans, certainly, Australians, nobody's doing anything except these empty gestures. So it's terribly depressing. And the Palestinians are grieving, traumatized by it. And it's not clear what's going to make a difference.
Well, there's people grieving all over the world. It's just that their governments will not bend over and take the action that they should be.
Exactly. As always. Maybe as in the past with East Timor and South Africa and other cases, and Vietnam, the Vietnam War, the huge public consciousness raising that took a long time finally made a difference in those cases. I think that is the case, that in the end, public sentiment becomes so important. I think in the case of Vietnam and so on, but at what cost to the poor victims? It's sad to think that you have to keep up this, you know, energy of the activists, and there's a lot of energy and outrage, but it's too slow, and meanwhile, the horrors continue.
Thank you very much, Peter.
No, good on you. Thank you, Jan. Thanks for speaking with me. I appreciate it.
And I've been speaking with Peter Slezak, Honorary Associate Professor at UNSW.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.